Good evening, everybody. Welcome back to the Mythgard Academy. This is session number 22, Until We Have Faces. And tonight, we enter into the final chapter of the book. And we're going to be starting with the opening of the chapter wherein we finally get the title of the book. Today, we're going to... we'll see how far we get. We saw Orawal being drawn into what was apparently the Deadlands. And today she is going to sort of get some of the fruit of that, in a sense, in that she is going to get to be reunited, especially, of course, with the fox. And that is probably what we're going to spend most of our time on here tonight. So let's jump straight back into things here. I wanted to pick up again, we kind of, at the end of last time, rushed through. So these first two we've looked at before, but I wanted to pause over them a little bit more. "Enough," said the judge. There was utter silence all around me, and now for the first time I knew what I had been doing. While I was reading, it had, once and again, seemed strange to me that the reading took so long, for the book was a small one. Now I knew that I had been reading it over and over, perhaps a dozen times. I would have read it forever, quick as I could, starting the first word again almost before the last was out of my mouth, if the judge had not stopped me. And the voice I read it in was strange to my ears. There was given to me a certainty that this, at last, was my real voice. There was silence in the dark assembly, long enough for me to have read my book out yet again. At last the judge spoke. "Are you answered?" he said. "Yes," said I. Just one quick thing that I would emphasize here. We saw already, we've had several kind of, cues, directives. Lewis has shown us in several ways, quite glaringly here at the end, what the reality of her heart is compared to what she has been telling herself. And of course, the irony is that even though she has described how her own writing of Book One showed this to her, right? Remember that even when she receives the book, when she notices that she's holding the book, and she's upset because she's feeling like someone must have swapped it. This is not the book that she wrote. This is not her handwriting. She labored and labored over this book. It was long and it was beautiful. And she has this little tattered, bedraggled hen scratch thing that she feels like is not really her book. So, of course, in that we already see this reminder that of the big gap between her own mental idea of her book and, of course, through her book, of her memories, and through her memories of her experience and her life itself, that was not the thing that she thought it was. Now, again, remember, she had said that her process of writing the book had already begun that process. She'd already begun to realize that many of the things that she had remembered once she started memory to work, it had become a tyrant, and it had taken her to places that she had forgotten about, or even that she had kind of covered up in her own memory. So she already spoke of that process beginning, and yet, when we get to this stage, it is clear that that was the merest opening to that dynamic, right? She had not really begun to perceive the depth of depth isn't the right word, the scope of the gap between the reality and of her remembering of it. Yes, now she, and when she reads it out, it comes out of her. And the chief emphasis here of this first, these first words after she stops reading her book, the first emphasis, is that she wouldn't stop reading it, right? Remember, she was resistant. This is not my book. I'm not going to read this. Actually, yeah. In fact, you've never stopped saying this, right? That's the sort of final reality that she has to confront. Not only that, in some kind of like objective sense, like when you kind of step back and look at it, that the thing that you did was not done for the reason, really done for the reasons that you convinced yourself. Just as she did fruitfully come to understand that her love for Bardia was not what she had always convinced herself that it was. And the more she looked at it, the more she could see that, right? But again, it's not only that. It's not just that matter of gaining the perspective to step back and see that from a distance, right? What she has here discovered. Again, it would have been bad enough. Imagine if she had heard someone else read it out, right? If she had, like, seen the book put on display. This horrible, snarling, ugly book, right? If that had been put on display and someone else had read it, right? That would by itself have been enough to sort of show her, again, from that distance, right? To give her that perspective, if she would be willing to see it, as it took her a little bit of time in that conversation with Ansett, right, to see the truth about her relationship with Bardia. But perhaps it might have been enough for her to see, okay, that is what my book was. That is what I really thought, what I really felt. But that isn't the experience that she's given. That kind of stepping back and looking at it and appreciating that kind of gap. Instead, she is given the opportunity to experience, to realize that this is her current reality. It's not just, this is the true version of the past, which I've been trying to change the past. We've talked about the whole changing the past thing for a long time, right? It's not just, I've tried to change the past, here's the reality of the past. There's that too, right? But it's not just that. It's also the present. And to see, to see that this is not only still what she would say right now, it's what she is always saying. It's what she would say forever, in a continual loop for all eternity. That's the thing that she is brought to recognize by this experience of reading out the book. And Hapuna Girl, I agree with you. I do think that this moment is very like this moment, not the moment of the reading, the moment after the reading, the moment of the realization, is the moment where she dies before she dies. She wasn't sure what that meant, right? It could mean several things. Die before you die, there's no time after, right? That this is the moment when she sets that aside. Are you answered? The judge says. Yes, said I. That admission. I think that that's the moment of her death before she dies. Yes. So, Morgul Hamster, you're totally right. Morgul says, it sounds kind of hellish. Yeah, sure does. Sure does. And for the record, Morgul Hamster, I would 100%. If someone asked me to choose a passage from a fictional work of C.S. Lewis that I thought most clearly illustrated C.S. Lewis's conception of hell and what the experience of being in hell is like, this would probably be my choice. The whole reading the book through this passage. Yes. I'm not going to talk about that too much because it involves like getting into C.S. Lewis's theology of hell, which is not what we're going to talk about here. Because again, like, we haven't read all the other books that we would need to have read to talk about that. But let me just say, yes, I agree with you. And exactly as Jack Rabbit was just saying, Orwell has spent her life rehearsing her grievances, and without intervention, she would spend her death rehearsing her grievances. And that's exactly what she herself has come to see here. It is, Jackie, as you say, a narrative loop that she was stuck in, and that this confrontation is the only way to break it. And remember what happened right before she started reading the book, when she was stripped, not just of her veil, but of all of her clothes, so that she was standing there completely naked before she started reading out of her book, right? This is that complete exposure. This is her chance to realize, to recognize, to acknowledge that this, the actual contents of this book that she read many times, this is who she is. This is what's under, this is what's under the veil. Yeah. All she had is her complaint, and her complaint was the answer. Yes, absolutely. Yes, and Hapuna Girl, you're right, with the days that never end. Yeah, exactly. Remember, she was already suffering under the sun in the desert and felt like she had come to that place in the Deadlands where the days don't pass. Remember, that was like sort of the ultimate horror. Humans can endure massive quantities of suffering, but at least in mercy, the days still pass. Right. But not here. And she here acknowledges this wouldn't have passed. Again, she would have read it forever if they hadn't stopped her. She had already read it perhaps a dozen times over. Think what that also suggests about the patients there, right? They didn't just let her read it, let her accuse the gods. They didn't just let her accuse the gods two or three times, right? They let her read it out perhaps a dozen times before they finally, the judge finally intervenes and says, enough, enough. And it's only then that she realizes that she's been doing it. Right. Mighty Felix, as you were saying, this is the answer. The book that she's reading is book one. Well, it's the heart of book one. It's the reality that underlay book one. It's the thing that book one was attempting to conceal from herself in some ways, right? It's not that there was nothing else in book one apart from that, but this is what was behind the veil. That was book one. And book one ended with this confident assertion that the gods would have no answer for her accusation. And of course, the gods don't give an answer. Just remarkable irony at the end of this chapter is that she was, on the one hand, not wrong, right? That the gods would not answer. And that if they didn't answer, it would prove her point, right? And in truth, the gods don't answer. Because they don't need to answer. The accusation itself is the answered. Are you answered? And she acknowledges that she is. That she is answered. Yeah, Hapuna, I agree. I do think that it's part of their process in teaching her, for sure. Yes, and Cal Elros, I agree with you. That also is a whole other can of worms, but I certainly agree with you. Cal Elros says this is once again where this book draws very close to the ending of the Book of Job. I agree. And I do think if someone asked me for a resource that might help them understand the end of the Book of Job better, I think I might direct them to this book. Yeah. Again, I'm not assuming everyone's read the Book of Job, but yeah, I agree. Interesting, yeah. Mighty Felix says, I can't even read Job without picturing this scene. Yeah, I mean, it's. Emily says, I still feel like Orwell is more sinned against than sinning. I think, Emily, what I would say to that is I'm not sure that those two categories are sufficient to address what's happening here, if you see what I mean by that. Again, it's one of the things, just as I have often said, that I think one of the things that makes Orwell a very remarkable narrator throughout, from the beginning, throughout book one, is her honesty, right? Which, again, she draws attention to later on. The ways in which she does not paint herself very flatteringly and says way more than she kind of needs to, especially if she's trying to make herself look good. And I think that one of the results of Lewis's use of Orwell as narrator is that C.S. Lewis has created a book which is itself also very honest in exactly this way. He doesn't make any attempt to show us simply an awful person. As I say, even when we see her being awful, we're also kind of cheering for her, right? Like we remain in Orwell's corner. I think we do, all the way through. And we certainly, so Emily, one of the things that I'm, when you talk about being sinned against, I suspect that what you're referring to are all the ways that we've looked at in which Orwell herself has been abused and mistreated, especially through her childhood, particularly by her father. And the ways in which, like, as I recall, that you have said on previous weeks, Emily, with her background, with her history of loving and being loved, it's hard to expect her to do much better. Emily says, for someone with such a crappy upbringing, I think she did pretty well. Yeah, no, I hear that. And again, I don't think it's wrong. I don't think it's wrong at all. Yeah. And, yeah, well, I'll say for now, I encourage you, Emily, to kind of hold on to that and watch where he goes in the last chapter with that. Let's keep going and look at the, so that's the end of the penultimate chapter, and then we have the beginning of the last chapter, which is the last thing I read, and we barely talked about it all. The complaint was the answer. To have heard myself making it was to be answered. Lightly men talk of saying what they mean. Often when he was teaching me to write in Greek, the fox would say, "Child, to say the very thing you really mean, the whole of it, nothing more or less or other than what you really mean, that's the whole art and joy of words." A glib saying. When the time comes to you, at which you will be forced, at last, to utter the speech which has lain at the center of your soul for years, which you have all that time, idiot-like, been saying over and over, you'll not talk about joy of words. I saw well why the gods do not speak to us openly, nor let us answer. Till that word can be dug out of us, why should they hear the babble that we think we mean? How can they meet us face to face till we have faces? Emily, I'm still thinking about your comment here. The point isn't that everything is all her fault, right? Notice the kind of sequence that she introduces here at the end. It's not about condemnation, exactly, right? It's not about, and again, it's another reason why I don't think that, like, the dichotomy between sinned against and sinning is quite the right or the full way to think about this. Because it's not about she has sinned, she is horrible, and is condemned because she's horrible and receives the, like, consequences of her actions, right? That isn't what's happening here. Notice how she lays that out here. She says, in our hearts, there's something that will be at the center of your soul for years. And notice, it's not that you don't say it. It's that you've been saying it over and over, idiot-like, all that time. You haven't heard it, but you have, right? All of your actions, all of your words, you're not admitting, you're not hearing your own voice. You're not standing there naked on the podium, right? You're not seeing your real book in your hands. You are dressed up nicely. You are veiled. You've made your nice book, right? And you've convinced yourself that you're saying something else. But there's this thing. Here she's talking about her own experience, right? That there was a word. There was a saying. She's just been saying it again and again, right? That needed to be dug out of her in order for her to be able to see it, in order for her to be able to hear it. She didn't realize. She never let herself realize that this is what she was saying all along. But, Emily, this is the point that I would come back to here. What happens when that occurs? It's not about condemnation. It's not about, like, she has sinned and is therefore condemned or convicted. Once that word is dug out of you, once she has said it, there is the prospect of hearing, you, of you being able to be heard. In order to be heard, you must first stop saying that thing that you, in your heart, keep repeating over and over and over, and which you express in everything you say and everything you do, right? Until you can let those things go, which shape those things, there will never be anything to listen to in what you have to say. You can't possibly speak to the gods or hear from them. How can they meet us face to face till we have faces? If you are veiled, if you are concealing your own face, if you won't lift the veil and look in the mirror, because you might see that you're unget, if you do, right? if you won't lift the veil, then you won't meet the gods face to face. It's impossible. And it's not their fault that it's impossible. Right? So, yeah, Jackie, something like that. You have to be willing to face yourself to face the gods. Yes. 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 Yeah. Until she heard her own voice, she couldn't hear the god's voice. Hey, I like that. Remember that I said that. I wasn't thinking about that. But yeah, until she heard, she could hear her own voice, she couldn't hear the god's voice. And watch what happens. Okay. Okay. Watch what happens. "Best leave the girl to me," said a well-known voice. "I'll lesson her." It was the specter, which had been my father. Emily, I'm not trying to pick on you. You're just, your comment was just really resonating with me, and I've been trying to think it through in these ways. But again, notice, Emily, how immediately the first thing we get is a reminder of that well-known voice, right? She knows her father's voice speaking in this kind of tone, right? She knows that voice very well. It's part of the bedrock of her whole life, right? One of the things that has shaped her whole life. Again, there's clear recognition of that, right? It was the specter which had been my father. Then a new voice spoke from beneath me. It was the fox's. I thought he too was going to give some terrible evidence against me. But he said, "Oh, Minos, or Rhadamanthus, or Persephone, or by whatever name you are called, I am to blame for most of this, and I should bear the punishment. I taught her, as men teach a parrot, to say lies of poets and unguents a false image. I made her think that ended the question. I never said too true an image of the demon within. And then the other face of Unget, she has a thousand, something live anyway, and the real gods more alive. Neither they nor Unget mere thoughts and or words. I never told her why the old priest got something from the dark house that I never got from my trim sentences. She never asked me. I was content she shouldn't ask why the people got something from the shapeless stone, which no one ever got from that painted doll of Arnhem's. Of course I didn't know, but I never told her I didn't know. I don't know now. Only that the way to the true gods is more like the house of Unget. Oh, it's unlike, too, more unlike than we yet dream, but that's the easy knowledge, the first lesson. Only a fool would stay there, posturing and repeating it. The priest knew at least that there must be sacrifices. They will have sacrifice, will have man. Yes, and the very heart, center, ground, roots of a man, dark and strong and costly as blood. Send me away, Minos, even to Tartarus, if Tartarus can cure glibness. I made her think that a prattle of maxims would do, all thin and clear as water. For of course water's good, and it didn't cost much, not where I grew up. So I fed her on words." Yeah, Hapuna, I find this a really beautiful passage too. The fox's confession. "I don't know why, I don't understand why, that last line makes me tear up, but it does. Water's good, and it didn't cost much, not where I grew up." Yeah. Remember, I've warned you, I'm going to be a complete basket case by the end of this book. Okay. First, even before we get into the details of what the fox says, first let's acknowledge, because it's very unbalanced, right? We get a very short speech from her father and a very long speech from the fox. And so that can almost distract us from the fact that this kind of choice has been made about her fate, about her direction, right? In response to the trial, what comes next? What comes next is that now she needs to learn. Having seen the truth, having heard her own voice, having heard the dreadful words that really lay under all of the things that she had said and done before that she had never admitted to herself, having finally had her veil entirely stripped away, now there are things she needs to learn. And there are two choices, right? And the two choices are her father or the fox, the two dominant forces of her childhood, right? Love versus whatever, abuse, basically. Understanding versus ignorance. Gentleness versus violence, right? Also, reason versus ignorance again and superstition. Even more, because her father was never really superstition. Her father was primarily pragmatism, right? Remember, for instance, him asking for a refund from the priest of Unget when he did not receive a son, right? Passion, Doc, yeah, absolutely. Reason versus passion, absolutely. Yeah, thinking of the fox's terms and the her father's her father is constantly hiring that mercenary army, right? How did her father assert his will? How did her father make his will be done? Through passion, right? By hiring the mercenary army, to use the fox's language there, right? Yes, Maureen, I agree. They are like the two authorities, really her two role models. Not like her. They were her two role models. You could say that Bardia was a kind of role model as well, except he was a little bit closer to being a peer. At least she, one is her father, the other is her grandfather. Bardia was on a different level, right? Yeah. And certainly, Jackie, as you say, for most of her childhood, they were her adult contact. Her whole context, really, for the adult world, Bata was the only other adult that she really had significant interactions with. So we get these two. And we get, again, the short speech from her father. His entitlement, his assertion of best leave the girl to me, right? This is obviously what should happen. She should come back under my dominion. I'll lesson her. The way he takes the word lesson and makes it into a transitive verb and makes it sound like a form of violence that he's going to perform on her. Especially, of course, since that's, of course, the primary context we have from her father, who was always acting things out through one form of violence or another, right? But the fox comes. One really conspicuous sentence. I thought he too was going to give some terrible evidence against me. Remember that not only is the fox not going to be giving evidence against her, she's not on trial, right? she has immediately switched into a mode where she feels that she's on trial, right? That was not her trial. That was the God's trial. She was the plaintiff. She was not the defendant, right? And yet she's immediately in that mode, right? Ooh, Bricktales. That's really, really good. Bricktales is thinking of the homophone, right? I'll lesson her, he says, L-E-S-S-O-N. But of course, in doing so, he would also almost certainly lesson her, L-S-L-E-S-S-E-N. Yeah, yeah. That certainly was always his method, right? To try to raise himself up by pushing other people down. Yeah, yeah. Yes, yes. Yes. Oh, Emily, that's such another really important thing, isn't it? This is another thing I've sort of struggled with in this book, is that in other stories involving these gods, they are cruel and capricious. Yes. And Lewis evokes those exact stories. Right. Exactly. Yeah. No, it's supposed to be a problem. It's a problem Orwell's had all of her life. It's a problem the fox had. Right. Yeah, Doc, there's good reason to see them as being cruel and capricious in this book, too. That's certainly... remember Bardia's attitude towards the gods, right? You know, he'll avoid doing anything that's known or suspected to tick off the gods, and in exchange he hopes they leave him alone. Because, you know, that's the only safe way to be, right? Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, so let's get to that, the relationship between the stories about the gods and philosophy, truth, as the fox would accept it, right? So let's get into the fox here. The fox's opening move is to say that he is to blame, that he should bear the punishment. There's a lot of things, I'm going to go through, there are several things that I think we need to make sure to notice and pay clear attention to. He says, I taught her as men teach a parrot to say lies of poets and unguits a false image. What does he mean by that? What's the parrot imagery about? At first, it sounds like he's insulting Orwell, right? That she was nothing but a parrot in repeating his lesson, right? But I think that there's another really important, I don't think that that's the case, right? Remember, he is confessing his own failings here, right? How is teaching her to say lies of poets and unguents of false image, how is that like a person teaching a parrot? Judy, exactly. You teach a parrot to say something, but you know the parrot doesn't understand. You know, I mean, like, there's a falseness, not, again, it's not the parrot's fault, right? It's not like just that there's an emptiness to the parrot saying the thing. Instead, there is a pointlessness, a foolishness to teaching it, right? Yeah, you teach the parrot to copy you because it amuses you, not for the parrot's benefit. Yes, the parrot is not being edified by any of the things that you're teaching it to say. I taught her as men teach a parrot to say lies of poets and unguents a false image. So remember these two things he's quoting. Unguents a false image, lies of poets. Now notice what he says about those things. I made her think that ended the question. Notice what he does not say here. He does not say, but I was wrong. He doesn't say he was wrong. I think he is actually reaffirming those things. The stories about the gods are lies of poets. Ungit is a false image. What he's repenting is making her think, making Orwell think that that ended the question. Yes, the poet's stories are not true stories of the gods. Don't capture the true nature of the gods. No, Ungit, the Ungit rock, is not a true image of the nature of the gods. Both of those things are true. But they don't end the question. JJ, yes, it prevent that, those things, those glib sayings, as he says, prevented her from pursuing truth further. Exactly. I never said too true an image of the demon within. In other words, yes, Ungit's a false image, but instead of mocking the primitive barbarian practices as he did, right, and just dismissing the superstitions of the barbarians, if instead he'd said, well, let's think about that image of Ungit, right? He said, he now realizes that Ungit is a true image. It's an image of the demon within. She is Ungit. She discovered that eventually. But even that discovery, too, was a kind of death. Right. And almost led to her literal suicide. He says, I should have helped her. In other words, notice what he's just said there. He's not said anything about the gods. Too true an image of the demon within. Right. By saying that, he is acknowledging there is something that we should have learned. She should have learned. I should have helped her to learn. Even from the image of Ungit in the House of Ungit. Just as, by extension, there are things that you can learn from the lies of the poets. Are they lies? Yeah. Yeah. Do they capture the true nature of the gods? No. No, they don't. Does that mean there's nothing that you can learn from it? Does that mean that you should just dismiss it? No. No. And then the other face of Ungit, she has 1,000. Something live anyway. And the real gods more alive. Again, he didn't go on this way. Neither they nor Ungit are mere thoughts or words. His philosophy. Remember what we talked about way back in like chapter 3. And I was trying to draw attention to it from the very beginning. Notice that division within the fox. Remember how that worked? What was the... And we saw it so many different times. We saw it on multiple different occasions. The division of heart within the fox. Do you remember what it was? On the one hand, he had his philosophy. He had his sayings, which he's now dismissing as glib sayings. Right? These things he is now characterizing as mere thoughts or words when he would talk about the divine being and all that kind of thing. Why did he always have to talk about the lies of the poets? Why did that come up so often? Because he used to read her poetry all the time. And from her earliest days, she could tell not only that he loved those poems, but that those were the books that he loved most and that moved him most. That he himself, that the fox got something from the story of Aphrodite and Anchises that he didn't get from his own philosophy. He even spoke of his own limitations, how he has not progressed far enough in philosophy. So he kind of acknowledged that his philosophy had been inadequate to shape his own heart and his own life. Just as, of course, Orwell found the same thing when she tried by her own philosophy to apply this sort of method and make her own soul beautiful, just in the last chapter, right? he had always found his philosophy inadequate. And there was something that he got from the stories. His own stories. And this comes through again and again. He's always making references to the myths, to the lies of the poets, these stories about the gods. Beautiful as Helen, beautiful as Aphrodite herself, right? At all of those times, right? It needed no Oedipus, right? He's constantly, that's his whole vocabulary. Why? Why is it his whole vocabulary? Because there's something there. There's something live there. There's substance there. Saying these are lies of poets doesn't end the question. It's not that it's untrue, but it doesn't end the question any more than saying Ungot's a false image ended the question. I never told her why the old priest got something from the dark house that I never got from my trim sentences. And that was that scene in chapter 5 when, I think it was chapter 5, with the confrontation of the fox and the old priest. And we were talking about, like, who wins the debate and that sort of thing. It's not even about who wins. What he emphasizes here and what Orwell herself saw very clearly on that day was exactly what the fox says here. That the old priest got something from the dark house of Ungot that the fox never got from his trim sentences. When it comes down to conviction, when their two worldviews came into to clash against each other, right, and to compete, what was clear is not necessarily that the priest was right and the fox was wrong, but what was crystal clear is that the priest's worldview worked for him, that he believed in it, that it did something for him that the fox's philosophy did not do for him. And he had things, the poetry especially, the stories. But he would run from those things, right? Sharon, exactly right. We see a reflection of this, a much gentler and more attractive version of this with the old peasant woman who received so much comfort from the Ungot statue but got nothing out of that painted doll of Arnhem's, right? She never asked me. I was content she shouldn't ask why the people got something from the shapeless stone which no one ever got from that painted doll of Arnhem's. His confession here is that he never taught her these things. And of course, he then goes on to confess why he didn't teach her. Why didn't he teach her what was really, what more there was to the question about the lies of the poets or the false image of Ungot? About what the priest got from the dark house that he never got from his trim sentences. What the peasant woman gets from the shapeless stone that no one ever got from that painted doll of Arnhem's. Why did he never teach her those things? Because he didn't know. Because he didn't understand. Of course, I didn't know, he says. But I never told her I didn't know. I don't know now, he says. What he's confessing, again, it's not that what he taught her was wrong. I have not yet, to this point in the paragraph, seen him actually recant anything he said. He's not taking it back. But he never told her what he didn't know. He had a sense. He knew at least enough to know deep down, that his own explanations were inadequate. I wonder what would have been in the fox's book. Right? If the fox were naked up on the pedestal, what he would say? What would have been that word that needed to be dug out of his heart? Maybe it's this. I didn't know. I don't know now. Maybe that's it. Maybe the thing he had to realize that he was saying over and over again was the way we saw him kind of do this, right? Whenever he is confronted with something beyond his philosophy, right? Like the way the priest acted, right? He tried to convince himself that he knew, right? That the true philosopher understood these things. That if you just back up and, you know, look at these things rationally, you can think everything through. I think that maybe the thing that would be in the fox's book, the thing that he was saying his whole life without hearing that he was saying it, is, I don't understand these things, and I am afraid of that. That makes me afraid. I can't bear to confront the fact that these are mysteries that I don't understand and can't understand. Maybe? I don't know. But I think that would be my guess. Yeah. JJ reminds me firmly in the voice of Aslan, I'm telling you her story, not his. No one has told any story but Orawal's. Yes, true enough, JJ. True enough. But in as much as the fox is revealing about himself here, I think, and Mrs. Manrique, you're right. Remember why water is cheap, because blood is not. Because we do, I think, begin to get towards that fear that I was talking about, right? It's not just confronting the fact that he doesn't know and doesn't understand. It's that there are things, the things that he doesn't understand are the things that scare him. I don't know now, he says. Only that the way... When he says only that, I believe he means the only thing... Like, he doesn't understand. He can't explain it. Even now, he doesn't understand the whole thing. He's not saying that now I could give her the correct lessons, whereas before I was giving her faulty lessons. But he has learned something, or at least now can acknowledge something. And that something is that the way to the true gods is more like the House of Unget. Certainly more like the House of Unget. Notice he doesn't finish that sentence. I wonder how he was going to finish that sentence before he interrupts himself. More like the House of Unget than it was like his trim sentences. More like the House of Unget than he had, you know, dared to admit. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly where he was going with that. He says, no, but because he interrupts himself. Oh, it's unlike too. More unlike than we yet dream. But that's the easy knowledge. The first lesson. Only a fool would stay there, posturing and repeating it. That's what he was doing. That's what it means to say Unget is a false image and think that that ended the question. That didn't end the question, that begins it. If Unget is a false image of what? And why that image? Why should that image have come to be associated with the gods in the first place? If the poets are lying about the nature of the gods, why do they tell those lies? Why? And of course, why do those lies that the poets tell move the fox so much? How is it that the lies of the poets seem to convey something that goes beyond what he can express, beyond what he can explain, such that when pushed to explain it, he instead pushes it away? Just as, how is it that the house of Unget can provide such comfort to the old woman, or even to the priest of Unget? Only a fool would stay there. Of course, the way to the true gods is unlike the house of Unket. Now think, by the way, notice how what he's saying shows us that the things that Orawal was experiencing near the end, like that trip to the house of Unget that we were just discussing a few weeks back, she was perceiving many of these things. Many of these things that the fox is here pointing to. That, on the one hand, the way of the gods must be very much unlike the house of Unget. Think of how repulsive she found the house of Unget. And yet, she found, both in the actions of the old peasant woman and in the response of the crowd, she was able to see there was something everyone was getting from this. There is something to this, as ridiculous, as repulsive even, as it seemed to her. There was something there. She was not merely doing as the fox describes himself doing, staying there, posturing and repeating it. The priest knew at least that there must be sacrifices. That is a truth about the way to the true gods. That it is that there must be sacrifices, that you can't walk the way, you can't get to the true gods without sacrifice. They will have sacrifice. They will have man. Yes, and the very heart, center, ground, roots of a man, dark and strong and costly as blood. Was the old priest right about the great offering? Was he right about the shadow brute? Was he right about the accursed? Was he... No. Of course not. But merely to say that is a glib saying. That doesn't end the question. Because he knew something. Was he wrong? Yeah. Of course he's wrong. But he knew at least that there must be sacrifices. There is still something to that story. That story at least points at a reality, like the poems, the lies of the poets, also point to a reality, though they're lies, and often absurd, right? Yes, Hapuna girl, the sacrifice is that we must die before we die. Yes, exactly, exactly. Yeah, Eric says, Orwell needed to be changed before she could understand the gods. She did need to die before she died. So perhaps the gods require sacrifice not because they need them, but because we do. Perhaps the devouring and the loving are one. To say that in a different way, Eric. Right? Yeah. Maybe. Maybe. Send me away, even to Tartarus, if Tartarus can cure glibness. I made her think that a prattle of maxims would do, all thin and clear as water. A prattle of maxims is how he characterizes his philosophy. Now, it's not that it's wrong. But it didn't cost much. Not where he grew up. Yeah. Ambrosia says, it seems that the gods require blood not arbitrarily, but because it is the life of a human and they desire to be close to humanity. Yeah. It's about, but again, I think it's about the sacrifice. I think we just saw it. The very heart, center, ground, roots of a man. What, like that thing that's left when you strip everything else away? I believe we just saw the great offering when Orawal was on the pedestal and reading her book. Yeah. Sharon, you're right. And when that happens, you get lessened, don't you? Yeah. Just as she found her book was so much less than she thought it was. Right? Yeah. Last comment, I saw some people talking about what he calls her. The judge, that is. O Minos or Rhadamanthus or Persephone or by whatever name you are called. And then he addresses the judge as Minos at the end. Minos, Rhadamanthus are both traditionally within Greek myths gods of judgment in the end. They have judging, they're given judgment roles. You can still see this even in Dante, actually. Minos is still judging, allocating. He's the one dividing people up and putting them in the right tier of hell. But anyway, so notice again, he's still speaking using the lies of the poets. Is Minos real? Is Rhadamanthus real? Is Persephone real? No! They're not real! Lies of poets! And yet, by using these names and acknowledging that he doesn't know what name the judge is really called by, he is showing there's something there, that there is a reality. He's looking at the reality that lay behind those stories. Right? It's Leif is completely his vocabulary, right? Absolutely. But again, notice how it's related to everything that he says here, right? Why is it that he adds Persephone to the list? I think this is very important. There is a kind of which of these things is not like the other. Minos and Rhadamanthus, all three, Minos, Rhadamanthus, and Persephone, are associated with the underworld, even with authority in the underworld. But Minos and Rhadamanthus are judges, like afterlife judges. They judge the souls of people in the afterlife. Persephone is the queen of the underworld. And Eric, yes, she's the one who comes back out from the underworld. Well, almost comes out from the underworld. And she's on, because she's, you know, on like parole. But anyway, queen of the underworld, right? I know, she just got out yesterday, right? Yeah, exactly. But why bring Persephone? I think there's a good reason why the fox is thinking about Persephone. Who's the judge? Within the frame of the mythic stories that Orawal is operating within, not speaking the fox's language, but speaking Orawal's language, who's in charge? Ungit's in charge, right? remember in her third task, which she's still kind of in the middle of? Remember, I didn't finish. She was supposed to go and find the waters of death and fill her bowl, empty bowl, with the waters of death and bear them back to Ungit so that Ungit will set her free. Right? Okay, so Ungit's in charge. So that the judge figure would be associated with Ungit makes sense. Not associated with Ungit by the fox, right? It's a judge person, so he first associates the judge person with Minos and Rhadamanthus. But then he throws in Persephone because this is a female authority figure, queen of the underworld, not just judge, right? So again, Persephone, or whatever, or by whatever name you were called. So I think that Persephone is his sort of acknowledgement. Again, Ungit is Aphrodite, not Persephone. He identified that a long time ago. But you see, I think that he's acknowledging. It is bringing it, as you say, Jackie, bringing it back to Ungit. I wanted to cry out that it was false, that he had fed me not on words, but on love, that he had given, if not to the gods, yet to me, all that was costliest. But I had not time. The trial, it seemed, was over. Notice she's wanting to testify in the trial of the fox. First, she fears that she's on trial. Then now she fears that, like, the fox is on trial, right? Yeah, exactly. She's thinking of him, right? And I think maybe that's why I started to cry when I was reading that line about water's good and it didn't cost much, not where I grew up, because I can't help but remember the fox gave up where he grew up. He gave up the Greek lands. He sacrificed his home and his family and his life for love of Orawal. As Jackie points out, Orawal's considering someone else's welfare, y'all. Yeah. Yeah. Now, this is, of course, not a rebuttal of what the fox has said. She hasn't said anything that disproves the things that he said about his own teachings and his own perspectives. But what she focuses on, what she sees, what she feels to be most important, was that far from a fool who had fed his pupil on vanity and empty words, he had fed her on love. And that he might not have understood the stuff about sacrifice. He might not even have been able to confront the reality of the fact that he didn't understand it while he was still alive. But he lived it. He did sacrifice himself. He had given all that was costliest. He had made the great offering to her. And yeah, Hapuna Girl, I agree that Orawal's surgery from the gods enables her to see this about the fox now. Yes. Yes. Peace, said the judge. The woman is a plaintiff, not a prisoner. It is the gods who have been accused. They have answered her. If they in turn accuse her, a greater judge and a more excellent court must try the case. Let her go. Which way should I turn? Set up on that pillar of rock. I looked on every side. Then to end it, I flung myself down into the black sea of specters. But before I reached the floor, of the cavern, one rushed forward and caught me in strong arms. It was the fox. Grandfather, I cried, but you're real and warm. Homer said one could not embrace the dead. They were only shadows. My child, my beloved, said the fox, kissing my eyes and head in the old way. One thing that I told you was true. The poets are often wrong. But for all the rest, you'll forgive me? Man, if there's one thing that makes me cry in films and in literature, it's reunions of people running towards each other and embracing after long separation. Oh, man. It gets me every time. Ah. Okay. We get here first, the reminder that nobody's on trial here. The gods were on trial here, right? The gods have been accused, and they have answered her by not answering her, right? If they in turn accuse her, a greater judge and a more excellent court must try the case. This is not the highest court. Where are we? What's happening? How did she get here? What's going on? This isn't the highest court. What court is it? What court is it? How did she get here? Do you remember? How'd she get here? The specters. Yeah. They carried her up. She body surfed, remember, on the specters up the mountain they pulled her in? Yeah. In what court do the gods go on trial? In the mortal court. Remember, what is this court? It's a pillar in the middle of the room, and then around it is this enormous, like infinitely enormous amphitheater full of people. Right? Jocelyn, exactly. This is the people's court. That's exactly what this is. This is the people's court. Yes. It's a jury of her peers. Exactly. Exactly. There is, on the one hand, from one way of looking at it, a kind of divine humility here. The gods submitting themselves to be tried, to be accused in the court of the people, in the mortal, within the sort of the context of the mortal realm. But then again, isn't that more or less what the gods are always doing? These are the same gods who allow those horrible stories to be told about them. These are the gods who don't seem to object to the House of Unget and its horrible ways. Right? Ambrosius, that's exactly it. First of all, no, she's not promised a jury of her peers. In fact, she's promised quite the opposite. But you see, the gods didn't have a jury of their peers either. First, we have the gods being judged by mortals. Then, the greater and more excellent court will be the one in which the mortal is judged by the gods. But the thing that we, but I think that that humility thing is important, right? And remember the result of it. The result of it is neither the conviction nor the acquittal of the gods. The result of it is Orwell's own Orawal's own self-knowledge, right? Her recognition of herself, the bearing of her own face, her looking herself in the mirror, looking at her face in the mirror for the first time, right? And yes, Liz, in the end, she, Orawal, is the one who finds the gods not guilty, right? She's the one who judges that her accusation has been answered. Yeah. Yeah. Ooh, Mrs. Mandrake, I'm so glad you remembered that. That Orawal has the blood of the gods in her. Yeah. The fox knew about that too. Remember how the fox did, you know, used to speak scornfully of the idea of the royal houses of Gloam, the royal house of Gloam having divine blood, right? But he did perceive that there was a truth that lay behind that. Yes, we all have the god within us, right? I think that's one of those things that he wasn't wrong about, though he didn't understand it, and though it was a glib saying. I think that we can apply the same kind of logic that he was just making in his confession to that as well. So is it real, Eric? No, of course not. No more than the Great Offering is real, or, you know, the Ungot Stone is real, right? But also no less than those things are real, or the other lies of the poets. And Mrs. Manrake, you are also correct to remember Orawal is a professional judge. Sitting in judgment is what she does, right? Yeah. And yes, I missed it. Someone was describing how she here throws herself off the pillar, very much like she was trying to fling herself into the river. There is a definite suicidal element. Which way should I turn set up on that pillar of rock? There is no escape. The only way she can escape is, well, to die, right? To cast herself off. To end it, I flung myself down into the black sea of specters. As if to take her place among the mortal dead here in the Deadlands. Right? But before she reached the floor of the cavern, the fox rushes forward and catches her in strong arms. The poets are often wrong. It's the one thing he told her that was true, he says. One thing I told you was true. The poets are often wrong. The fact that she immediately thinks of Homer when he catches her, right? Homer, which obviously he taught her. And think of the way in which that particular saying of the poets, it's truly, by the way, Homer's depiction of the underworld is one of the bleakest and most horrible that I know of in mythology. And I agree with Jackie. Eric was asking why was she so desperate to end it. because of the hellishness of the experience. Exactly. She'd already, even before she came into this place, come to the place where the days don't pass anymore, right? From the time when she was already up in the desert through when she saw the, you know, snakes and scorpions, through the experience of the trial and the stripping naked and the book and the reading and everything else. Her father reappearing, goodness gracious. This has been her own experience of hearing her voice and that continuous repetition that would never have ended. This has been much like hell. So to end it, yeah, to change it, right? To break out anything, to break out of this loop. She flings herself down. Very much like she wanted to fling herself into the river in order to stop being Unget. And she's caught. Yes, she had no other choice. She retracts her complaint and now has no point to her life, but she falls into a loved one's arms. She is saved by love. This is the response to her own outcry. He fed me not on words, but on love. They know this. And his love is able to catch her and to sustain her, to keep her from the death that she seeks here. The fox did have something that he gave her. Everything that he said about his teachings is true. But she is right. He fed her not on words, but on love. And we see his love sustaining her. Because glory be, the poets are often wrong. The stories about the underworld, the stories about the gods, they are lies, thankfully. There is more to it than that. The gods might perhaps be more than the stories suggest. Just as the shades in the afterlife turn out to be more than what Homer knew about. But for all the rest, you'll forgive me? I to forgive you, Grandfather? No, I must speak. I knew at the time that all those good reasons you gave for staying in Gloam after you were a freeman were only disguises for your love. I know you stayed only in pity and love for me. I knew you were breaking your heart for the Greek lands. I ought to have sent you away. I lapped up all you gave me like a thirsty animal. Oh, Grandfather, Ansett's right. I've battened on the lives of men. It's true. Isn't it true? Why, child, it is. I could almost be glad. It gives me something to forgive. But I'm not your judge. We must go to your true judges now. I am to bring you there. My judges? Why, yes, child. The gods have been accused by you. Now's their turn. I cannot hope for mercy. Infinite hopes and fears may both be yours. Be sure that whatever else you get, you will not get justice. Are not the gods just? Oh, no, child. What would become of us if they were? But come and see. We'll come back to that last part in a minute about the justice of the gods. What we will see in a little while is that Orwell understands that part perfectly well about the justice of the gods. He asks for her forgiveness for the limitations of his teachings as he was just confessing. And she instead takes the opportunity to ask for his forgiveness. Notice how with the reference to Ansett makes it perfectly clear. Remember, Bardia wasn't there. She didn't encounter Bardia. She didn't see Bardia, right? But what she's learned from the Bardia, well, from the Ancid experience, really, but about her love for Bardia, what she's learned there leads her to ask forgiveness in this way. Sorry, did you lose my audio for a minute? Yeah, sorry, I don't know what happened there. Yeah. Internet blip, perhaps. Okay, sorry. Where did you lose me? I was talking about the Ancid experience, what she learned from Ancid, and how she's immediately applying it when given the chance to see the fox again, to speak to the fox again, to be wrapped in the arms of the fox again. She immediately, she's, no, no, I must speak. She acknowledges the truth that she never acknowledged, the thing that she never dared to say to him. Why? Because she was busy saying that other thing the whole time. Right? She was busy reciting that, all those very, very selfish things. Right? And she admits the truth, that she knew the truth, and that it was her own selfishness. I lapped up all you gave me like a thirsty animal. Ancet's right. I've battened on the lives of men. It's true. I really am Unget. I am the spider. Right? Isn't it true? Why, child, it is. I could almost be glad. It gives me something to forgive. Because forgiveness is a gift he can still give her. Because forgiveness is another expression of love. He could almost be glad that she had done some wrong to him so that he can forgive her. He doesn't deny it. He doesn't try to hide or run away from the fact that, yes, she did act quite selfishly. But I'm not your judge. That is, yes, he's delighted to forgive her. But I'm not your judge. He has been given the role of bringing her to his true judge, to her true judge. Now, remember, there were two choices. And I think that now we are seeing what the choice was about. The choice between her father and the fox, right after her recognition, her realization. Her father and the fox both come forward. I think both of them are volunteering for the role of taking her to her judges. The fox wins. The fox wins. The fox is to bring her to her judges. Her physical father and her emotional father. Yes. Yes. So I think there's a spoiler contained here, right? Her father, as Bricktails had pointed out, was going to lessen her, right? The fox is not going to lessen her. I think that perhaps her true judges are kind of tipping their hands here a little bit. Don't you think? I think so. She is not here to be lessened. Nah. Never mind. Okay. I couldn't remember where the other thing about not getting justice came in. I couldn't remember if it was the next slide, if it was further down the road, and it's further down the road. Jackie, she's not going to be lessened. She's going to be transformed. She's going to be increased. Right. Remember how Psyche looked taller when Orwell met her again? How bright face she was? Notice also, battening is also kind of the opposite of lessening. She tried to gorge herself on the lives of men. She characterized herself as swollen fat with the lives of men. But that's not a way to actually get bigger. Batten sounds like Bata. Yeah, kind of does, doesn't it? Bata was both very fat and very selfish. And it was Bata's face that the Ungot face looked like. It was Bata that she compared the Ungot face to before she realized that it was her face. Right. Okay. The fox, in taking her to her true judges, is now going to show her a bunch of stories which, unlike the poets, do not lie. We are going to finally get some true stories. Stories still, right? Representations still. Paintings on the wall. That will be like the myths, but they will be true stories, not lies of poets. All right. But let's stop there. This is as good a place as any to end. Next time we will look at the paintings and her interaction with the paintings. We're getting there. We're in the middle of the final chapter for next time. Thanks, everybody. A few more weeks. We're getting there. I should be around next week. So I look forward to continuing our way through this final chapter next time. All right. Join us next week when I probably won't be able to read the passages without crying either. thanks, everybody. See you guys next week.